In Canada, Joe Clark begins his less than one-year term as Prime Minister, as Jimmy Carter serves the final year of his one-term American presidency. Ronald Reagan becomes the president-elect, while Margaret Thatcher leads the Conservatives to victory and begins her long run as the British Prime Minister.
The average movie ticket price is $2.47.
A gallon of gas costs 86 cents, or about 22.6 cents a liter.
On television, 60 Minutes, Three's Company, That's Incredible, MASH, and Alice are the top-rated programs, while Lou Grant and Taxi pick up Best Drama and Best Comedy at the Emmys.
On the radio, The Knack's My Sharona, Donna Summer's Bad Girls, Chic's La Freak, Rod Stewart's Do You Think I'm Sexy, and Peaches and Herbs Reunited were the top singles. The Doobie Brothers won the Grammy for Record of the Year for What a Fool Believes, as well as snagging Best Group. Billy Joel and Dionne Warwick pick up honors for Best Male and Best Female Vocalist.
Sony introduces the Walkman.
John Wayne passes away at the age of 72.
The Maytree Circle by John Ludlum is the best-selling book.
Trivial Pursuit is created. In science, Alan MacLeod Cormack and Godfrey Newbold Hounsfield win the Nobel Prize in Science, Physiology, or Medicine for developing computed axial tomography X-ray technique, or as we more commonly know it, the CAT scan.
In the news, the Shah leaves Iran after years of turmoil. Revolutionary forces under Muslim leader Ayatollah Khomeini take over. Iranian militants seize the U.S. embassy in Tehran, beginning the Iran hostage crisis, where 52 U.S. diplomats were held hostage for 444 days.
The accidental release of anthrax spores at a Soviet bioweapons facility in Sverdlovsk kills several hundred.
At a December 3rd Who concert, 11 fans are crushed to death.
On March 28th, a partial meltdown occurs in Unit 2 of the Three Mile Island nuclear reactor in Dothan County, Pennsylvania, releasing a significant amount of radioactivity. However, there are no deaths or injuries to plant workers or members of a nearby community which can be attributed to the accident. Coincidentally, the movie The China Syndrome, a film about a nuclear plant accident, is released just a few weeks before the Three Mile Island incident.
It's 1979, and this is Hermaphobia. Welcome to 1979. I'm Alan.
And I'm Mark.
And we're going to be taking a look at all the films of 79. Well, most of the films of 79.
Yeah, or just, okay, a small portion of the films of 1979.
You know what, dude? It's not a small portion. We're going to be looking at quite an extensive amount of film. We'll be breaking it down by genre, by critics, by...
directors.
Box office.
Yeah.
It's going to be a fun little journey. I think this is going to be the first part of a two-parter, and shall we just jump on in and get going?
I got my swim trunks on. Let's go.
Oh, God, nobody needed to see that. Dude, don't wear Speedos.
It's 1979. Of course I'm wearing Speedos.
No, you'd be wearing the little hot shorts with the piping on the side.
Yeah.
Yes, and on that note, let's carry on. Okay, let's start with the top 20 films of 1979. We are using the list provided by the Box Office Report, and let's start at number 20.
That would be Starting Over, and I've got nothing about this movie. I have not seen it that I'm aware of.
I myself have not seen it either. It is a, from all accounts, a romantic dramedy, comedy, whatever you want to call it there. It stars Burt Reynolds, Jill Clayburgh, and Candace Bergen. Mm-hmm. It actually managed to fare out a couple of Academy Award nominations for the stars, Candace Bergen, but not Jill Clayburgh. So. Mm-hmm. Haven't seen it. I would probably not mind seeing it, but we just were not able to see everything.
And some of these movies are really hard to come by now.
Yeah, fuck yeah.
especially seeing as we don't have a working VCR hooked up to any TVs anywhere.
Oh, find a videotape somewhere. Can't even do that. Number 19 is All That Jazz, which was the semi-autobiographical film by Bob Fosse starring Roy Scheider.
Yeah.
Again, another one we haven't seen. We're starting off real strong here.
Yeah.
again, another Academy Award nominee, multiple nominee. And so let's get to something that we've seen so you know that it's going to be really, really quality, great stuff, because, you know, we're doing these lists and we're talking about these great films, and so number 18 is...
Love at First Bite.
Oh, fuck. This is a comedy starring George Hamilton, Susan St. James, Richard Benjamin, and, oh, what's that little guy, Artie? He was on Laugh-In and all that sort of stuff. Anyhow, it is a, it's a comedy about Dracula in New York falling in love with a modern woman. And
because he gets kind of like thrown out of his castle.
Yeah.
And he has to find a new place to live.
Artie Johnson, that's his name. But yeah, it's, I think it was funny in its time, but it's very, very dated.
Yeah, I haven't seen it since it first came out. And after reading up about it on the IMDb, I'm not even sure if I saw it in the theater now or if I saw the VHS release.
Oh, I saw it in the theaters and everything.
Which, from what they say on the IMDb, the VHS release was totally mutilated from the original version.
Yeah.
Which is why I'm thinking that I didn't care for it as much.
Mutilated as in?
A very, very poor edit.
Oh. Well, I have it on DVD. I bought it on DVD because I loved it when I was a kid, so I was like, oh, cool, I can sit down. Why? I don't think I made it through 30 minutes of it. It's bad. It's just bad. Number 17 is Meatballs, which is good, really good. Bill Murray starring as a camp counselor in an early Ivan Reitman comedy.
And, you know, I know I've seen this, but I can't remember a thing about it except for Bill Murray's in it.
Oh, no way. No, it's great.
I should get around to watching it again because I like early Bill Murray because he's just insane.
Yeah. No, it's a fun movie. Christopher Makepeace, who was, went on to be in My Bodyguard and Vamp.
Mm-hmm.
He plays Woody the Wabbit. Can I remember that? It was a great film.
And it spawned all kinds of sequels. Not that that's any good indicator of a movie or anything, but...
A lot of direct-to-video sequels. Number 16.
Escape from Alcatraz. This is a movie that I read the book before I watched the movie. And the book was so much more richly detailed than the movie, obviously. But the movie was still entertaining just the same. Clint Eastwood in the starring role. And I like seeing the bad guys, like the prisoners, as the good guys. And the prison as an evil that had to be overcome. It was kind of a heart-lifting movie, even though it was like, hey, these are scumbags escaping from prison.
Yeah, it eluded me then, it eludes me now. I didn't have a great deal of interest in it then, and I still don't. It's funny to watch these earlier, they're not even the earlier Clint Eastwood films. Sort of the mid-Clint Eastwood films. And he was doing a very, very different kind of movie in this period, you know. Mm-hmm. This was right around the same time he did, Firefox and Every Which Way But Loose. You know, he was kind of either doing the...
Firefox was later.
Not much later. Not 79 Firefox? That had been, 83?
Maybe, yeah.
That's only a few years away, dude.
Yeah, I know, okay.
But, I mean, that's the kind of film that he was doing. I mean, he was definitely serving the masses at this point.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
He was pandering to his audience.
Yeah.
And not to the Oscar community.
No. No. Right turn, Glenn. number 15 is 1941, which is probably the biggest failure from Steven Spielberg to date.
Yeah, and again, this is another movie that I've seen, and that's about all I can say about it. I can't remember a single thing about it.
Dude, what are you doing
here? There's a lot of good actors in it.
Oh, there's great actors
like,
in it.
Great comedic actors like John Belushi, Dan Aykroyd, and I got nothing. I got nothing about this movie.
Lorraine Gray, Ned Beatty, Wendy Jo Spears, who cracks me up. She was the best part of it. It's the right after Pearl Harbor has been attacked. And they think, it takes place in L.A.
Yeah.
And they figure that, you know, they're next kind of thing. And it's just about the paranoia and the partying and everything else. You know, how sort of everybody responds differently to war. And,
yeah. I wouldn't mind watching it again now to see if I get more out of it as an adult.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, we were like 10 and 11 years old when it came out. So
yes, I probably haven't seen it in the last 10 years, but I've seen it as an adult.
Oh, okay.
And it's not a good movie. I mean, it didn't, you know, it's not, you know, a hidden gem by Spielberg that, you know, really deserved better than it got. Or
so it probably like made this top 20 list because of the names that were in it and people went to go see it.
As I recall, it was a summer comedy, so, you know, got you out of the heat for a while. after that is
The China Syndrome. And I have to thank my mom for working in a video store and bringing home movies for me to watch all the time. If it weren't for her, I wouldn't be able to see a lot of these movies because I couldn't get into the theater to go see them, for one, or they didn't come to my town, which only had like a single theater. Even as a kid, I enjoyed this movie, even though I didn't quite buy into the anti-nuke message that it was giving out. The acting was all superb, and Jack Lemmon being passed over for the Oscar that year must have been a difficult decision. That's all I'm saying. Like, it was great, and it made you scared about nuclear power, even though that's...
Well, the thing is, I mean, it came out a few weeks before there was an actual meltdown, so there was more than the movie to make you fearful of nuclear power. I think China Syndrome was what would you use as the word? You know, it definitely benefited from the disaster that was happening in the world.
Yeah, that's
it became very, very, very topical. And not because it was to begin with kind of thing. I don't really think it was a movie that was on a lot of people's radar.
I think the word that we use today is viral.
Exactly. You know. Yeah. Yeah. It was a movie that I don't think was really on everybody's radar. But after the Three Mile Island incident, it was on freaking everybody's
must watch list.
Yeah. You know, and it wasn't so much this film as what actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
When did Chernobyl happen? Like,
I was like 86.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, it had people's ideas tainted about nuclear energy. Or it had less to do with tainting people's ideas of nuclear energy as Three Mile Island did. But yes, it is a good film, and it is very, very well performed across the board. Michael Douglas, Jane Fonda,
mm-hmm.
Jack Lemmon, everybody's great in it. It is a really good movie. Number 13 is The Black Hole, and with the good, you take the bad.
Yeah.
You take them both, and there you have it. I think that was on right around then too, wasn't it?
Facts of life. This is a movie that I was gagging to see when it came out.
Oh, fuck yeah.
Because all the advertising and the hype for it.
Yeah, and it was a Disney film. It was a Disney-branded sci-fi flick.
Yeah, and like it was on all the friggin' cereal boxes.
Oh, fuck yeah. I had an action figure. I had Vincent action figure.
I think I had Maximilian.
Oh, I had Vincent. You could pull his head up and down, and then the little leggies came out, and it was his head spun around. It was fun.
Yeah, I seem to remember that there were some like games on the sides of the boxes as well to play with these little figures or whatever. And isn't it strange that I didn't actually see it until last week?
You had not ever seen it?
I had not ever seen it. I thought I had seen it until I watched the first few minutes of it, and it's like, hey, I haven't seen this.
So what was your take on it?
Wow. Not what I was expecting at all.
What about the film did you like, and what about it didn't you like?
I found it to be on par with the Buck Rogers movie about the same year.
No.
But...
Not as entertaining?
But not as well done. Yeah. Some of the concept in it were probably lost on the target market for it. Like really, really like high heaven and hell kind of concepts. And the zombies, and it's like, I'm glad I didn't see it now as a kid, or also I would have been awake for many months.
See, like, I did see it as a kid, and none of that stuff really kind of, I mean, that was a higher level for older people kind of thing, right? We didn't really see it in that fashion kind of thing, any more than we thought of RoboCop as a zombie.
Yeah.
You know, you're really kind of extrapolating an idea to fit into a certain confine. But the fact of the matter is, it was boring. It was endless, long model tracking shots. Oh my God. Like, if you edited out the redundant, overlong shots of the fucking models pulling in and out of bays and flying over the camera, and you'd lose 40 minutes of the movie right there.
Or the like 10-minute action sequence of the robots firing lasers at drones or little light balls and stuff.
Okay, and then Vincent, the cute little R2-D2 unit in the fucking movie with his painted on eyes, like, what the fuck was that about? It was so bad. There's just nothing about it that was good. And
yeah, the technical flaws with that movie are way too numerous to even mention, but just the ESP connecting to the robot and not to the other crew. It's kind of a weird little ESP. But I remember when putting Ernest Borgnine in a movie was a box office draw.
It wasn't in 79. He was done by then.
Yeah.
He was done. It was fucking tag, you're out. Fuck. But however, it did provide the eye candy, which is Robert Forrester for the excruciatingly, in between the excruciatingly long fucking model shots.
See, this is another instance of a movie that I probably should have left in my childhood.
But obviously you didn't see it in
your childhood. Yeah, I didn't see it in my childhood, I know, but I should have left it there anyways. Ah.
The number 12 film of the year was The Main Event, a comedy with Barbara Streisand and Ryan O'Neal, where she plays a fight promoter who is hedging her bets on what's considered to be a loser. I remember trying to watch the show back in the day. It was brutal. Streisand,
I got nothing on it anyway. So.
Streisand and Ryan O'Neal, they were great together in What's Up, Doc? But this is no What's Up, Doc. This movie just blows donkey dick in a big way. I can't believe that it ranked this high in theatrical take. Says a lot about the star power of Streisand.
Yeah.
At number 11 is The Electric Horseman, which is a great movie. I love The Electric Horseman.
And I haven't seen it.
That's sad. That saddens me a little bit, because The Electric Horseman, I can't even tell you how many times I've seen The Electric Horseman. It's a great movie. It's about Robert Redford, who's, you know, kind of at the height of the whole rodeo circuit, and he has a great deal of affection for this horse who's, you know, this thoroughbred champion that's been drugged and shot full of hormones and everything else to make it a higher performing champion. And he kidnaps the horse and takes it out, and he wants to set it free with the wild Mustangs out on the Colorado plains, I believe. Jane Fonda plays a reporter who goes chasing after him and the story and everything else, and it turns into a bit of a romance and everything else, you know, the odd couple that fall for each other and everything. But it's probably the first film that I can really think of that actually kind of brings the whole animal rights issues into play, and for that it's really, really cool.
What about Planet of the Apes?
And on to number 10, The Muppet Movie.
I didn't watch this for a couple years after it came out, and don't get me wrong, I love and still do love The Muppets, but it just never came to my town, and we had to wait for it to come to VHS. I remember absolutely nothing about this, nothing, except for the fact that I watched it with my sister.
Yeah,
Could have been The Muppets doing doing porn, for all I know.
Yeah. I mean, I liked the Muppet Show back in the day. It was great, especially when Debbie Harry was on. Yeah. But the Muppet movie was a little long. It was just a little long. I think it was probably a little bit too much for kids' attention spans, and probably a little too kiddish for adults. But it did really, really well. I mean, enough so that it spawned how many sequels and other theatrical shots and stuff like that. It wasn't the Muppet Show, and I think that was really what I was expecting.
And the Muppet Show was like quick little bursts of things. So that's like all the Saturday Night Movie or Saturday Night Live movies that have come out, like based on skits. It's like, yeah, they're only good for those 10-minute skits, even though they pound them out to like 15 and 20 minutes.
Yeah, and I mean, the movie had all sorts of little celebrity cameos and stuff like that. As I recall, Steve Martin was in there, and a bunch of other people. It ran long. That's really just where I was with it, is it was just too long.
Alrighty. Number 9 was Moonraker.
James Bond.
Yeah, and I remember going to go see this with my dad, my best friend, and his dad, and it was kind of like a guy's night out, and there was pizza involved, so looks like a lot of my memories have food involved in them somehow. I don't know why I'm so heavy. But I had liked this one the best of all the Bond films for a while, I think because of Richard Kiel, the actor that played Jaws. He was a bad guy that decided to change his lot in life because he was in love. Now, the pairing of Jaws with that tiny, tiny little woman was a bit comical, but l'amour, it's blind.
I have very peripheral memories of it, and I've seen it for the first time probably in the last 10 years.
Really?
I was not one that I was really that gunned about. I wasn't a big James Bond fan back in the day, and I was never really juiced about seeing Moonraker, and even after having seen it, I could have lived without having seen it. Not one of the best Bonds for me, though the Bonds that I really, really like, I'm sure other people will say are the worst of the worst of the Bonds, so.
I'm not going to get it there, but let me guess, Denise Richard plays Christmas Jones.
No. Number 8, The Amityville Horror. This movie was notorious, I guess, because of the novel.
And I think that's my problem with it. I said, I'm not sure if I've seen it or not, because I did read the book. Like, I was an avid reader. Like, I read like a book a day. And I think I remember a lot about it. I don't know, but the book might be coloring my memory of it.
It's crazy, you have 2 weeks to get ready for a little show like this, and you don't take the time to revisit it, but you're watching Asian films in your office 10 minutes before we do them. Anyhow, The Amityville Horror was a great movie. It really became a signpost of the times. I don't think there's anybody that didn't know about The Amityville Horror.
It did scare the pants off
me. Yeah. If anything bad happened to you, in a house, you'd be, it's the Amityville Horror house. It's like,
Remember that little red room? I'm not sure if it was in the, movie or was it just
in the basement?
Just in the book?
But I mean, there was a lot made about Jody with the red eyes. It was one of those movies. Mm-hmm. I think probably one of the first films since The Exorcist that really got under the skin of the collective
consciousness. Or just the masses.
The masses, really. Everybody had the frame of reference, be it from the book or the film. And Margot Kidder was still hot off of Superman, so, she was in that. And James Brolin, the future Mr. Barbara Streisand, was in it as well.
And it's thanks to this movie, too, that I still, to this day, anthropomorphize houses. Like, two windows are eyes, the door is the mouth, like that. Yeah, it's creepy.
It became very iconic, and it recently was remade with Ryan Reynolds. Ryan Reynolds. And you know what? Of the remakes that have been unnecessary remakes that have been made recently, it was actually not too bad in terms of the remake. Number 7, 10. Oh, 10.
You're going to think I'm nuts here, but I've never seen it.
I really want to hit you with something right now, because 10 is a great movie. This is Blake Edwards finally doing something that doesn't involve fucking Inspector Clouseau. He's examining the whole midlife crisis thing with Dudley Moore.
And even at that young age, I knew that Bo Derek was hot. But all I've ever seen was a clip of her running on the beach. That's it. I've never seen the movie or anything else of it.
This is wrong. It is absolutely hysterical. You've got Dudley Moore, you've got Julie Andrews doing one of her first R-rated films for her husband Blake Edwards, the director. It was another one too that it really became the pop culture of its day. I mean, everybody had that frame of reference, you know. Like you said, the running on the beach. I think that image is so iconic.
Yeah.
And even
the number system, 10.
Yeah.
That is still used today.
Yeah, the perfect 10. Great movie. Great movie. This is where, before the show, I was saying to Mark, you know, if anybody's listening at all, I'm going to get crucified for the following. So I'll hand it over to Mark for now.
Number 6 comes in at Apocalypse Now. And I haven't seen this movie in about 12 years or so. And yeah, there's not much standing out here. Listeners to our show will know that I bought the Fancy Schmancy DVD set of that a few months back. And it has everything in it, but I've yet to rewatch it. Basically, all I've got from the movie are a couple of scenes that are like stuck in my head, like "Love the smell of napalm in the morning."
Well, I think that. I mean, we were talking before the show that of the things that became part of the pop culture, that is one of the few that remain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Dirty Harry's.
Do you feel lucky, punk?
Yeah, go ahead, make my day. That kind of thing.
Yeah,
you know that line is probably still. Probably the most infiltrated into pop mm-hmm. culture from that era, but
and the only other thing I've got from the movie are trivia facts, like Martin Sheen had his birthday, and the fact like that scene where he's all drunk and smashing up the hotel room, he was really drunk and smashing up the hotel room because it was his birthday, and he was all depressed. And yeah, Marlon Brando didn't learn any of his lines, so he ad-libbed his entire set of scenes. It's just crazy stuff that I know about that movie, but yeah, I remember nothing about the movie except for, Robert Duvall and his napalm scene, and Lawrence Fishburne dancing on the boat when they're playing music.
Yeah, It probably took me about 4 attempts before I was able to watch the movie all the way through. And much like 2001, when it was over, I was like, and? Mm-hmm. Like, it's one of those movies, it just completely eludes me why it became so ingrained into the pop culture. You know, like, why... I think we discussed this a little bit in the pre-show episode that we did last week or the week before or whenever.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't get why people attach to this film when there was other stuff that was probably a lot more relevant at the time. Like, it just, I think there's been plenty of films that have, you know, demonstrated that war is hell and that, you know, it's a crazy, crazy thing and all that sort of stuff. MASH was what that was all about, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, Altman managed to ferret a film, and they went on to make a 10-year running TV series about it. Mm-hmm. So, and I mean, through that, they had something to say about it. War's not my thing to begin with, but I do know that, you know, there's at least an entry point with MASH. There's something that you can connect to, characters you can connect to that...
Yeah, because, like, even the main characters in MASH didn't want to be there.
Yeah. And I mean, they guide you through the experience. Whereas with Apocalypse Now, there is nobody to guide you through this. There's nobody to relate to because everybody is so out there. Like, they're, you know, And it cracks me up too when people, well, you know, it shows war the way it really is. How the fuck do you know? You were fucking sucking your mummy's tip when these guys were at war when this was going on. So,
yeah.
You know, it just, I don't get it.
I'm a big fan of war movies. And yeah, I've got nothing about this movie. It's just really weird.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like much ado about nothing. Whereas number five, if I could write sonnets to movies, I would write one to this, because number five is Ridley Scott's Alien, and it is probably one of the greatest films ever made.
It is in my top two movies of all time.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is simply probably the best movie that came out in 1979, in my opinion.
It's just, you know, it is an amazing movie. It, on every level, Ridley Scott shows us stuff that we have seen before, but not this way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, probably the first time we've kind of really seen sort of space junk. You know, the whole idea of the space trucker and hauling, you know, this big massive. It was work. It was a horrible freaking grind that these people had to endure.
Yeah,
to
make it wasn't the glamorous Star Trek
Wars adventure, you know, where you know there was no force to be, you know, it was great. The idea, the premise, the characters, everything about it was fantastic. H.R. Giger's designs for the alien and the sets and everything else, mind-blowing.
Yes, and like, this is the standard to which all science fiction / horror movies should be held up to. Like, there is, like, even though like the computer and technology plays is kind of hokey today because of, well, what they had back in 78, 79, even though that's there, it's still an enjoyable, watchable movie to this day.
As far as the technology goes, don't discount it, because bear in mind that right now, still in airlines, their whole theater systems and everything are still being ran on fucking Windows 3.1.
Yeah, okay.
You know, a lot of bank machines are still being run on 3.1. You know, like, technology in every aspect of our lives does not carry forward the way that it does in other ways. So I think it's still believable when you see the DAWs, like, you know, scripting that's happening across the screen and stuff like that, the ticking and all that. These were old. If you think about it, it's an old ship outfitted with old tech, because it's just
it's basically an 18-wheeler.
Yeah,
driving from A to B.
Yeah, you know, it's as standard. It's as like standard as in manual as any ship could probably possibly be in the fleet at that time, kind of thing, or in space at that time. So that part of it is amazing. The Giger set designs, amazing. The creature effect, amazing.
The cinematography is just
there's stunning. Nothing. It's amazing. Ridley Scott really kind of pulled a page out of Psycho, even, where, you know, you think that the central character in this film is Dallas, the captain, and then he does a little fucking bait and switch on you, and as we all know, fucking Sigourney Weaver's the star.
Like the building up of tension was almost like Hitchcockian,
slow build up. Like, it is such a slow wind. I don't think a film could get made like this now, because they're going to want you to have that, you know, money shot every 15 minutes, where you're going to be trying to get people to jump out of their freaking scenes. Where do you even see the alien in the first 40, 50 minutes of the movie?
Yeah, I can't remember. I don't think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's... it. Brilliant. Like, brilliant acting by everybody.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, yeah. Like, even Yaphet Kotto, who, I mean, good guy. You know, like, you know, I'd party with him. But
I liked him on Homicide, Life on the Streets.
But, I mean, he tends to go big.
Yeah.
You know, and he's big in this, but contextually it works. Harry Dean Stanton, who tends to be small, is small in this. Mm-hmm. But contextually, it works. They play off one another.
And they do it so well as the kind of like mechanics on the ship. And it's just, it's brilliant.
Veronica Cartwright with all that, you know, nervous energy and mm-hmm. John Hurt with his very, you know, kind of placid, almost, you know, quiet way. Everybody's great about it. And, mm-hmm. Who plays Dallas? Jesus
Christ.
Fuck,
I just had his name ahead.
I got his face right in front of me here. It'll come to me. Anyhow, he's amazing. He's the every guy. He's the person that people in theater sit down and instantly relate to. Whereas Sigourney Weaver's character comes off as, what a bitch. Like, you know, like she's so the one that you want to see get fucking taken down by the alien first thing. Mm-hmm. And she ends up being the hero and the beloved hero for three sequels. And of course, you have to pay respect to Ian Holm,
yes,
for his role as Ash. So quietly disturbing, like, you know, just
understated, brilliant.
Yeah, yeah.
Like and the alien ship set design.
Yeah,
I want to know the backstory of that.
Oh, exactly. Yeah,
just from just that.
Well, that's quick Giger's little vision. Shot. Like, you know, that's
I want to know.
That's just it. I mean, Giger's vision is so fully realized that, you know, you realize that you're stepping into something that's completely developed. You know, there's no fog around it, kind of thing, right? And that's just it. You want to know what the whole story, what the history and everything is there. It's a brilliant film. I don't know what more to say.
So this is Hermaphobia, the alien edition.
Yeah, no doubt. We should do that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Do like the entire series.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Love me some aliens.
Oh, yeah. And we'll sit down and we'll rewatch them all.
Yeah.
Just back to back to back. And yeah. Oh, baby.
We've already done that, though.
Yeah, I know, but we'll do it again.
Number four. The sequel to the 1975 or 1976.
Yes, I think it was 76.
Yeah, Oscar winner.
Yeah,
Rocky was Rocky II.
And after a near perfect movie like Rocky, why would you have to make a sequel?
Rocky could win.
Which I know. Then that's just that. It was pretty much just a remake of Rocky. Only Rocky got to beat Apollo at the end. Not my favorite movie. But I still found it entertaining. But yeah, I wish that they would have stopped that at Rocky.
Yeah, it's a complete retread of the first one. It really isn't bringing anything new to the table. Not that really any of the sequels did, but I think this is another case of where Stallone came in with a really great original premise. Did a fantastic first movie for it and then sequelized it to the point where it absolutely diminished what the original really was. He did that with First Blood
and he did it with Rocky. And it's also become part of the pop culture as well, because you see in movies about the future that come after this, they'll like show on the marquee Rocky 27 or something like that.
Yeah. Number three, this is one of Mark's favorites.
Yeah, quite possibly my favorite Steve Martin movie, The Jerk. I think what does it for me is a love affair between Steve Martin and Bernadette Peters. And their innocence at the beginning, which gets corrupted by all the money and they can have everything that they wanted because of all the money. And then at the end, their eventual salvation. And the duet between Steve and Bernadette on the beach with the song You Belong to Me, still to this day, is one of my favorite songs in movies.
Yeah, you've been dripping about that for the last 3 weeks. I don't know what the hell is going on you there, but...
Be quiet! I like my movies, man! Just be quiet! But yeah, I had no idea. Like, I searched YouTube for that song just because I had it in my head, and... I had no idea that there were so many different versions of it, and that I thought that Patience and Prudence, who I thought were the original singers of that, weren't, but like fucking like years and years before that, it was.
I just had severe deja vu, and I'm sure everyone listening did too. You did this on the last episode of with earworms on Herbophobia.
Really?
Yeah. You should actually listen to the show sometime.
Yeah, I probably should.
Yeah, The Jerk's a really funny movie. It, again, probably not to the same extent as the napalm scene and everything, but it does still carry some pop cultural references into now with, you know, the whole, the new phone book's here. I know I do it every time the new phone book arrives. And, yeah, I mean, it was funny. I think that was Steve Martin's really big breakthrough flick, was The Jerk. We'll get there. He did some rather interesting stuff in the 80s, but it's...
Yes, indeed, he did.
Yes. Man with Two Brains, anybody? Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid?
Watch Pennies them all.
Pennies from Heaven?
Watch them all.
Watch Pennies from Heaven.
I've watched it a couple times, actually.
Oh, my God. All right.
Yep.
Number two, the Star Trek franchise makes it to the big screen.
With Star Trek, the motion picture, and being a Trekkie... I was quite happy to see Star Trek being rebooted after being off the air for so long. I had seen all the TV episodes several times over and even had a bridge set with a few action figures when I was a little bit younger.
Geek.
Shut it. And they weren't dolls. They were action figures.
Geek.
Imagine my surprise of being bored out of my seat watching this movie. It has a great premise, and I liked how they brought together the crew and some of the characters out of the Star Trek mythos. But to a 10-year-old used to a much faster-paced TV show, I found it to be a bit plodding and overused the visual effects. I'm sure that if I could have dropped acid before watching it, I would have enjoyed it a lot more. But scoring acid in L.A. Lake in the 70s...
probably a lot easier than you thought.
No, but for a 10-year-old, probably harder.
Probably
than
a
that.
Lot easier than you thought.
I still have to rate it as one of the worst Star Trek franchise movies, despite my love for most things Trek.
I know that when I saw it when it came out, I walked out of the theater. It was painfully dull, especially to a child. I've seen it as an adult, and I liked it. It really wasn't that bad. And I'm so not a Star Trek fan. Like, so not a Star Trek fan. I can't say that it's definitely not one of the greatest science fiction films ever made by any stretch of the imagination. Interestingly enough, though, it is directed by Robert Wise, who did the original The Day the Earth Stood Still, which is being remade and released this winter. He also did West Side Story. So I believe he did The Sound of Music, too.
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
Because I've had the, I don't know if I can call it the privilege of watching The Sound of Music. It's a good movie.
It's a great movie.
But I've seen it 3 times in the last week.
I could do that.
Because I work at a day program, like everybody knows.
Yes, yes.
And the hills are alive.
He's a Julie Andrews fag. That's basically why he just, can't get enough.
I am
baby.
16, going on 17, and I may...
The best is How Do You Solve a Problem Like Maria. That's the best song. But yeah, it was directed by Robert Wise, and he was old at this point. I mean, like, he was probably well into his 70s. I think that maybe his age kind of played into the pacing a little bit, where he may have had a little bit more attention to spend than people with life ahead of them.
but still, you have to admit that they were I think in the control room masturbating over some of the visual effects they were doing there, because they were...
I think one thing that can be said in its defense is that Star Trek was actually a really intelligent movie. Like, and I think that's why when, as a kid, it completely eluded me, because I didn't know what the fuck they were talking about.
I like the premise of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, they incorporated the science fact into the science fiction, and it became self-aware and everything else. And I think that it's cool. It was a very, very smart premise. Definitely not what we were seeing in science fiction at that point. which we'll be talking about later. You know, it was I mean, it was highs and it was lows, and there wasn't a whole lot of in between.
Plus, I'd like to know who was the race that actually repaired Voyager originally and sent it back to find its creator.
See, you're talking about the minutia of the film, of which I saw as an adult 15 years ago. So yeah, I really couldn't tell you. but it's a movie I wouldn't mind seeing it again when I've got, what, 3 hours to kill, and
or what feels like 3 hours,
and I'm hopped up on meth. And the number one film of 1979 was Kramer versus Kramer.
All right, a little closer together. Come on, smile. That's it. Hold it.
Isn't this terrific?
Columbia Pictures presents Dustin Hoffman and Meryl Streep in Kramer versus Kramer.
I just gotta call the office before they go.
Joe, you're gonna be real proud of me.
I'm leaving you.
Was this some kind of joke?
I want my son.
You can't have him.
What makes you so sure he doesn't want me?
Late.
I'm not that late, dude. I'm only 20 minutes.
All the other mothers were there before you.
I'm not saying he doesn't need his father, but I really believe he needs me more. I'm his mother.
My wife says that she loves Billy, and I believe she does, but I'd like to know, what law is it that says that a woman is a better parent simply by virtue of her sex?
Kramer versus Kramer.
Wow.
It's a great movie.
What a lot of raw emotion in this film. After watching that little making of featurette on the DVD, you get to see where it's all coming from.
Yeah, I actually went back a little bit and looked, and I mean, divorce rates at that point are pretty much around the same where they are now. It's basically around 50%. So, but I think prior to Kramer versus Kramer coming out, I think that there was a lot of guilt and blame being assessed around divorce, and I think Kramer versus Kramer kind of let a little bit of the steam off of that. You know, mm-hmm. I know that when I watched it, it was something that I was going through in my life or had gone through, and didn't really have it reflected anywhere. I mean, even still on TV, it was still big happy families in sitcoms and stuff like that. You know, it might have been the late 70s, but you know, in TV land, it was still fucking the 50s.
Yeah,
it was a really really cool reflection of what my family was going through. And. And it was interesting to see it then, because, I mean, I totally saw it from the kid's point of view, and there was a good guy and there was a villain and everything else. You know, when you're at that age, you know, there's, you know, daddy's bad, mommy's good, and vice versa or whatever kind of thing. But when you see it as an adult, you really, really, it really hits home. I think that's when it mm-hmm. really fucking twists your guts up, because what do you do? What do you do?
Yeah, like when it came out, I had no interest in it at all, because the subject matter had no relevance for me. At least for another 2 or 3 years, then it did. And I had to make those decisions because my mom put it on me. Like, who do you want to live with, your dad or me?
Yeah.
And it's heartbreaking. Yeah. The whole process is just like somebody scrubbing a brush over raw nerves, and it's just And this movie really shows it, and why it doesn't hold up to viewing today, I don't think. I
think it's still as relevant as it ever was. You know, however, I think maybe our ideas of parenthood have changed in the last 30 years. You know, that a man can do as good a job as a woman, and I think it's pretty much universally accepted that a man can raise his child as well as a woman can. So we've kind of crossed that barrier, so maybe it is a little less relevant today in terms of the battle of the sexes aspect of it, but the whole breakdown of the family is at the core of the movie, and that's the part that just fucking shreds you.
Yeah, especially as an adult watching it now. As a kid, I didn't get that much out of it.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Curiously, Kramer versus Kramer was rated PG, and it has a scene of full frontal nudity. And this is what I'm really looking forward to exploring. In all of this too, is how the times have changed, sort of where we become more liberal and where we become more conservative. But yeah, Jo Beth Williams does a full frontal nude scene when she comes out of the bedroom. I mean, it's just for a flash of a second kind of thing, right? And she comes out of the hallway, and little Justin Henry standing there, and he sees her, and he starts asking her about, oh, what the hell is it? It was about some fried chicken or something like that, if she likes fried chicken. And she's sitting there covering her covering her dark spots. But that was rated PG. Like, I mean, that would not, if you saw bush or nipple on, in a movie now, R, boom.
Yeah.
You know, you could bleed, you could fucking slit somebody's throat, hang them upside down, and bleed them. PG-13, maybe.
Yeah.
But God forbid, an areola. So those were the top 20 films of 1979. I was going to say 1920.
But what I found kind of interesting is that in the top 20, 13 of them were released in either June or December. Like, 7 of them were in June, and 6 of them were in December. So, what's that, 3/4
of the... Well, I mean, okay, you're seeing films like Kramer versus Kramer, Apocalypse Now, China Syndrome. You know, you've got your Oscar bait films that are going to come out later in the year. And, I mean, you've got other films that are definitely summer films, adventure films. Moonraker, 1941,
Rocky,
Meatballs, all that kind of
Rocky
stuff.
Rocky 2, yeah.
You know, so I mean, you can almost look at it and see where, just by knowing what the movie is, you can pretty much tell when it would be released. And you have to think too that the release model is so much different than it is now. These movies did not rely on 50% of their take being opening weekend. These movies ran for a year. They ran for 6 months. They ran for 8 months. They got jumped around to different theaters, and they were able to build an audience. And, you know, where they may not have really hit really big in the beginning, they might have moved on to other places where audiences did notice, and then all of a sudden,
like word of mouth,
yeah,
started up, and then
they would return. There'd be a return engagement for it, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Because you couldn't go rent it at the video store in 1979 because there was no video store.
Yeah, it's completely different market.
It was a different world. It was a really different world. I mean, we'll be talking about it later too, but I mean, distribution models in terms of international releases and stuff like that have changed so much too. We've come across a few films where we'll see, you know, well, it says it's 1979, but you know, why is it, you know, why is it in the 1980 Academy Awards or you know, but the like Tess, which I'll be talking about later because I want to tell you I love some Tess, but it was released in 79. In parts of Europe. It wasn't released in North America till the end of 1980. And then it was released in, like, it wasn't released in the UK until, like, 81. So, you know, but they didn't have to worry about piracy. They didn't have to worry about, you know, they didn't have to worry about their customer base distributing the film for them. So they could, you know, just take their time and just let it build, you know. It was a very different world.
Oh my God! The new phone book's here! The new phone book's here!
Well, I wish I could get that excited about
nothing! Are you kidding? Page 73! Johnson! Maven! R! I'm somebody now! Millions of people look at this book every day! This is the kind of spontaneous publicity! Your name in print that makes people! I'm in print. Things are going to start happening to me now.
1979 wasn't exactly filled with laughs aplenty. The comedy pickings were somewhat slight.
You could almost say slim pickings.
Yeah.
He was in... he was the voice of Bob in The Black Hole.
We pretty much talked... We talked about the biggest comedies of the year, and they were pretty much the better comedies of the year, which isn't really saying much. One that I personally loved from 79, and I've talked about before, is Rock and Roll High School.
Yes.
Yes, I can't get enough of that. The Ramones, PJ Souls, we've been there, we've done that, we've talked about it. We know what my appreciation is. There was also a cute little film called A Little Romance, which was with Laurence Olivier, and it was Diane Lane's first big film, where she was, I think, like 12 or something like that. She was really young. And it was a sweet little film. And a very, very little film. Like, it was just a cute little romance. Not between Olivier and Blaine, might I mention. It was another French little boy or something like that that she liked.
Alrighty.
There was one that you particularly liked, though. Monty Python's Life of Brian.
Yes. Being the geek that I am, I rather enjoy The Life of Brian. And it's funny stuff. It's classic Python. You know, timeless. You can watch that now and you get the same one of it as you got back then. Like, it was great stuff.
I was never a huge Python fan. I mean, I loved Meaning of Life.
Mm-hmm.
But that's pretty much the beginning and middle of my liking of
well, The Meaning Python. Of Life was a fantastic movie, though. That's The Life of Brian, I liked. It was cute.
Yeah.
It was the whole spoof on the whole Jesus thing. That's what I think I liked about it the best. 1979 also had Peter Sellers in Being There.
Oh, which was, yeah.
Where he played this kind of touched individual who was, like, raised by television. And I remember watching it when I was sick, and I really liked it. And I liked the little thing at the end where, like, he walks away from the building and he was walking across the water. So I was like, oh, so is he the second coming? Or, you know, like, back then when I thought that religion really mattered.
You know. I tried watching it and I could not get into it. It just didn't appeal to me. I found it to be very slow. Shirley MacLaine's in that, isn't she?
I think so. And one thing that I remember in this was the old man, the millionaire, who was, Chance's guardian at this point, was dictating his will or something, and he had a microphone, and it was coming up on a little computer screen as he was speaking. So it was like speech to text back in 1979. I was like, that was pretty damn cool.
An interesting little trend in comedies of 79 were the comedy stylings of Don Knotts and Tim Conway, who made a few features that year. The Apple Dumpling Gang Rides Again. What was the other one here? The Prize Fighter. And I believe there was one other. If not, it came a couple years later, the horror spoof one.
Oh, that, I remember seeing that in the theater twice, man.
Yeah.
And I had it on VHS, and why can't I remember the name of it right now, but I know that the monster in that movie was the Wookalar.
Wookalar, yeah.
And he drank that buzzard pus ink. Oh, fuck, I laughed my ass off that movie. It was great. Great stuff.
There was another one, too, that I saw. I remember seeing it in the theater, and I have not seen it again since, which was called A Scavenger Hunt, which left me with one of my favorite quotes from film ever, which is, "They killed Montclair," which was a French maid mourning the death of a toilet. Yeah, that's really about it in terms of the comedies of 79.
Like, there were obviously more comedies, but
really nothing of note.
Not a lot of comedy.
Yeah.
Admiral, Mr. Scott, those departure orders, 12-hour Starfleet cannot be serious.
Why aren't the Enterprise transporters operating, Mr. Scott?
Oh, we problems are just temporary. Admiral, we have just finished 18 months redesigning and refitting the Enterprise. How in the name of hell do they expect me to have her ready in 12 hours?
Take me over, please.
She needs more work, sir. A shakedown.
Mr. Scott. An alien object of unbelievable destructive power is less than 3 days away from this planet. The only starship in interception range is the Enterprise. Ready or not, she launches in 12 hours.
Science fiction in 1979 was a little on the slight side as well, too. But it released a batch of very influential films. We already talked about Alien, which spawned three sequels and, you know, a couple of Versus films.
Yeah.
But also that year was the theatrical release. Now, Americans are going to go, that wasn't released in theaters, but it was in Canada and in Europe. Battlestar Galactica, which was the actual pilot film that played on ABC in the U.S., mm-hmm. played in theaters in Canada, and played in theaters in Europe. And actually, as I recall, it had a little bit of a sex scene inserted with Starbuck and the little blonde chick.
Cassiopeia?
Yes. So,
yeah, I'm a Battlestar Galactica nerd, too.
Yeah. but it spawned the TV series, and the groundbreaking TV series that we have now was based on what was kind of a crappy show
back then. No, we've already talked about the Black Hole as well, but also...
Of the ones that kind of expanded beyond their life in 79 was Buck Rogers in the 25th Century.
I remember going to see this in the theater. It was my dad and I went to go see this. And, I remember driving home and just, like, tweaky.
Dude, we played fucking Buck Rogers in the 25th Century in the playground for, like, months after that. Like, it was the best. And then the TV series came out, was it the following year?
I think the next year.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, it turned into a TV series as well. And 79 was also the year that Mad Max came out, which, as we all know, spawned the Rogue Warrior and Beyond Thunderdome. Yeah.
And Star Trek, the motion picture we've already talked about, has spawned,
10,000 sequels?
Well, 10 sequels, counting the one that's coming out this year, is called Enterprise.
Yeah. It's called Star Trek.
Or Star Trek, yeah. Or Star Trek Zero, they're calling it.
Okay.
Which is also Star Trek 11. All the TV series as well, like The Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, Enterprise. Yeah.
But, I mean, all of those were sort of derived from the original series. I wouldn't say that they were derived from the film.
But it was the success of the Star Trek movie, Star Trek the motion picture, that drove that.
But Khan was a lot more successful.
Well, yeah, but they wouldn't have made The Wrath of Khan if this first movie wasn't successful.
Okay.
So, like, hey, this one here, it made $5 million. Let's sink some more money into the next one.
They've almost convinced me. Also, we had Time After Time was released with Malcolm McDowell and Mary Steenburgen, where he plays... Is he Sherlock Holmes? He was H.G. Wells, wasn't he? He's the guy that made the time travel machine, right? It was H.G. Wells?
H.G. Wells
wrote the book.
Yeah, H.G. Wells wrote the book.
So that's who he was playing. Jack the Ripper escapes into his time machine and goes back to 1979. So Madell ends up following him back. And that's where he meets
Mary. Back to the future?
Yeah, as it were. And yeah, that's where he hooks up with Mary Steenburgen, and they track down Jack the Ripper in contemporary times. Sounds very convoluted and ridiculous, but it was actually a really good movie.
Mm-hmm. Also, The Clonus Horror. A fairly crappy movie about making of human clones and harvesting their organs. Very, very relevant for like today's time.
Mm-hmm.
Groundbreaking back in 79. And it even spawned a movie called The Island with Ewan McGregor and Scarlett Johansson. Like, that was a remake of The Clonus Horror. I remember watching it as a kid and thinking, like, wow, that's pretty damn cool. Even though, yeah, it got, like, some really, really savage ratings.
Yeah. Cool. So, yeah. Well,
Plus, there was, like, the unidentified flying oddball, which was the spaceman in King Arthur's court. You just be quiet. I remember getting the book from Scholastic. And I enjoyed it. And it was another Disney movie, you know. Like, and I remember the theme song, like, unidentified flying oddball. No. Oh, now I fucked it up.
Yes. Yes, you did.
Anyways, I thought it was kind of funny back when I was a kid. Now I would probably not laugh through the entire thing.
So that was science fiction in 79. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of releases, but a lot of influential films came out that year.
Yes, indeed.
You still don't understand what you're dealing with, do you? perfect organism. Its structural perfection is matched only by its hostility.
You admire it.
I admire its purity, survival, unclouded by conscience, remorse, or delusions of morality.
Again, things were pretty light in the action front. We've already discussed Mad Max, Moonraker,
Escape from Alcatraz.
Rocky. So that really only leaves... I'll just quickly mention that this was the year that Airport 79 came out. But that was sort of the last of the airport disaster flicks. And after that, it's over to you, my friend.
The first Great Train Robbery, also released as The Great Train Robbery with Sean Connery and Donald Sutherland. I enjoyed this. This was the sting for me back in 1979, even though it wasn't quite as good and as convoluted as the sting. I still felt it to be like kind of on par with that. The way they got onto the train and stole the gold, and it was a great little caper. I liked it. Liked it a lot.
Yeah, I know that it still has quite a few fans, but it was just one I never did see. Also, this was the first year that Chuck Norris took the reins as a leading man with Good Guys Wear Black, which I actually did see in a theater.
Okay.
I know.
I probably did as well, but I'm probably blocking it from my memory.
I really couldn't tell you what it was about or anything. I do remember the commercials where he does the little karate kick into the windshield of a car, and then he's wearing sunglasses. He's all about sunglasses, apparently. but that's the action films of 1979. We have a list of 20, and that is it that came out that year. So not the best year for action fans.
No.
That's the end of our first part of 1979.
Ooh.
Next week, you can listen to the exciting conclusion.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. So if you like what you've heard thus far, make sure you're there for us next week. And if you've got any comments about what you've heard so far, send them to hermaphobia@gmail.com or
post on hermaphobia.blogspot.com. We'll be glad to hear from you.
Absolutely. So until next week, when we continue looking at 1979, this is Alan.
And this is Mark.
Have a good one.
Friday night, and the strip is hot. Sun's gone down, and the route's dropped. I'll try. Spirits high, and legs look hot. Do you wanna get down? Now don't you ask yourself.
Said the last time. I was flowing until you corrected me.